linking herself with these other powers, she too would become a great power. We're not in the business of becoming a great power. We're in the business of being God's people and letting His power work through us for His plans. Now, Nahum has a number of problems, and they come out very clearly. Perhaps we should just read a verse or two in the letter, in the prophecy itself, because like Jonah, he doesn't prophesy a great deal, but he shows us a position where into which we often get. He has all kinds of problems and doubts, and often it's a sort of a conversation between God and the prophet Nahum. The burden of Nineveh, the book of the vision of Nahum the Elkoshite. God is jealous. The Lord avengeth. The Lord avengeth and is furious. The Lord will take vengeance on his adversaries. He reserveth wrath for his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger and of great power, and will not at all acquit the wicked. The Lord hath his way in the whirlwind and in the storm. The clouds are the dust of his feet. He rebuketh the sea. He maketh it dry. He drieth up all the rivers. Bashan languisheth, and Carmel, and the flower of Lebanon languisheth. The mountains quake before him. Verse 6, who can stand before his indignation? Who can abide in the fierceness of his anger? His fury is poured out like fire. The rocks are thrown down by him. The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and he knoweth those who trust him. But with an overrunning flood he will make an utter end of the place, and darkness shall pursue his enemies. At the same time, the man has a problem, and God has to encourage him about this. Verse 3 that we have just read is one of the points that he's going to make. The Lord is slow to anger. This, we say in the notes, this is the mystery of his long suffering. And Nahum apparently had something of a problem with that if you read through the book carefully. We have this confirmed for us, of course, in the New Testament. Almost the whole of Romans chapter 9, where the apostle, by divine inspiration, points out that God has set aside his own people, the Israelitish nation, and that has been blessing for the Gentiles, that he will bring Israel back, there is no question. But he shows how long God forbore in his patience and wisdom and grace before he did push Israel to one side and send blindness of heart to them. Then he warns the Gentile and says, but don't boast yourselves against the branches. If they were cut off, if the original stump of the fig tree was cut off and you were grafted in, don't boast against the branches, lest he spare not thee also. God is long-suffering. One day is with the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. We have the same thing, of course, in 1 Peter chapter 3, where he says, people say, where's the promise of his coming? Why doesn't God do something about it? Why doesn't he blow them away? Why did he permit this? Why did he permit that? The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some men count slackness, but he waits in long suffering, not willing that any single one, to singular, should perish. He's just waiting. And of course you will remember that it's mentioned again in connection with the flood in those days, that God waited long before he sent the flood. And of course we know that in Genesis chapter 15, God told Abraham that it would be 400 years after his time before he would bring the people of Israel in as his instrument to destroy the wicked nations of the land of Palestine. 400 years, and God knew ahead of time. Abraham didn't. It would seem from that whole incident in that chapter, Genesis 15, that Abraham thought the promises in Isaac would all be brought about in his lifetime. And God had to tell him, "Thou shalt go to thy fathers in a good old age." And by the way, when I started translating that into Chug, of course you have to look up the meaning of every word. You can't just slide over it. So often we use the word good in a very loose kind of sense. We use it all the way from, I got a good price on that. That doesn't mean that it was good in quality. It means it was satisfactory to you. We also go as far as to say he got a good slap in the ear for what he said. Now, that might or might not be a good thing, might be a very bad thing, but we use the word good like that. He was going down the road at a good old speed. But when I looked this up to make sure about the meaning of the word, it actually means good in quality. A good old age. Many a man has gone on through his life very well for God and made a complete fool of himself in his old age. Chapman prayed, he said, every day. He lived to be, was 101, 100 anyway, I think it was, he got to be 101, Robert Cleaver Chapman of Barnstaple. And he said he prayed every day that God would keep him from becoming a wicked old man. And so, Abraham, he said, you're going to die in a good old age. Very nice word. But he said, these promises are not going to be fulfilled in your time. You see, you will die, but I'm not dying. I'll be around. And why did he wait for 400 years? The iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. He waited and waited and waited. They were wicked, dirty, filthy pagans. They were polluting God's earth. You've only got to read chapter 1 of Romans, chapter 1 and chapter 2. One shrinks from reading that in public with a mixed audience. It's so dirty. They destroyed themselves in body. If you notice, all the three parts of the tripartite man are dragged in there. Every part. They chose not to receive God. Their foolish hearts were darkened. They destroyed their own bodies one with another, and all their affections were polluted, spirit and soul and body. Wherefore, three times, God gave them up. As to their bodies, to pollute themselves one with another, as to their minds, and as to their souls, the evil affections that they developed, given over in spirit and soul and body by God. And when you get to the end of the chapter, I think you'll find a catalog of evil into which they plunged, and I believe there are 21 of them. In other words, 7 for each one of those body, soul, and spirit. That's what the pagan world was about. God destroyed it first with a flood. Now he waited and waited and waited, and he's going to destroy it through the means of his own people. That is why this was not just an indiscriminate slaughter. This was not some God who's like a vindictive old crank up in heaven getting pleasure out of smashing people down, or that he chose to make Israel a bloodthirsty pack who would just fight everybody in sight. No. Israel was God's chosen instrument for the punishment of the people of the land. And yet, he waited 400 years to see if they would turn, and they didn't. Though, of course, he knew the end from the beginning. God is slow to anger, plenteous in mercy, of course, and he keeps waiting. This is the mystery of God's suffering, of God's long-suffering and patience. When I look at our world today, when I think of the things that are happening at the moment, for example, in what was Yugoslavia, the brutality of man to man, the mass graves, the sheer shooting down of women and children and old men, it's enough to curdle one's very blood. But then, we have to remember that dear Mr. Stalin massacred 9 million of his own people during his reign. And when Churchill mentioned about the 5 or 6 million who were killed when he was moving the peasants onto collective farms and they wouldn't go and kill them, ship them up to Siberia because they wouldn't go, and when Churchill, in one of his impish kind of moments, said to him, "It must have been a terrible thing when you had to massacre 6 million of your own people." And Stalin said, "Yes, it was. 6 million? And they were his own people." When we think of the camps of Hitler, we're just left speechless. That old women, young women, children, old men, sick men, if they weren't able to work, stripped of all their clothes, their hair shaved off to sell, to pack mattresses or something with, their gold teeth pulled out, and anything that they had used for other purposes, and that even one woman delighted in having them skinned and making lampshades out of their skins to ornament her home with. I can't remember her name, but she was called the Bitch of Dachau, or Buchenwald, I've forgotten which. It's almost inconceivable that such wickedness would be carried out, and yet it was. These people were herded, moaning and screaming, into great barracks half the length of this building, with vents in the ceiling, turn on the switches, send the poison down, bring them out. I have seen the ovens where these people were burned up. They had trolleys, kind of a bogey, and it pulled out of this long thing, and then they just put the bodies on top, pushed it in, turned on the heat, blew them to pieces, pulled it out, put some more on, and there were ranges of these from that wall, half the length of this building, just shuttling back and forward. And it was prisoners, other prisoners, who had to do the work to their own people. And yet God seemed to be silent. That's the problem of some of these prophets. Long suffering. He waits and waits and waits. And so we have this here. In spite of this, number two, he is jealous. Now we have to watch this word. He is jealous. God is jealous. Because we think of jealousy, in general, we think of it as a mean kind of a thing. Oh, she's a terrible jealous woman. He's just so terribly jealous, he can't look out of his eyes. But jealous is the counterbalance to true love. It hurts God. We touched on this before. It hurts God when the love of his heart, his own people, do the wrong thing. Yes?
Just made me think of when David said, "Let us fall now into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great, and let me not fall into the hand of man."
That's right.
And you know, before Jesus, it was said he was betrayed into the hands of sinners.
You'd have to repeat it. Go ahead. It will be going on to tape.
Well, it just made me think of when David said, "Let us fall now into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great, and let me not fall into the hand of man." And yet of the Lord Jesus, he didn't have that privilege, for it said of him that he was betrayed into the hands of sinners.
Right. God, long-suffering. In relation to that statement, Henry, what must it have cost God the Father to be long-suffering as he watched his Son, his co-equal, his eternal co-equal, treated as he was treated? And then you have a picture of the long-suffering. But God is jealous. He loved his people Israel. It hurt him when they were hurt, but it also hurt him when they failed in their devotion to him. Every time they went astray to idols, they were breaking his heart. He was jealous over them with a godly jealousy. And as I think I mentioned before, the man who would say about his wife, "Well, yeah, sure, she wants to run around, doesn't bother me, I wouldn't be jealous about it." I would question his love, wouldn't you? God is not like that. He has this love for his people, and he is therefore jealous. In spite of this, he is jealous, which must not be interpreted by human jealousy, which is narrow, bitter, and self-centered. The last word is the most important one. Our jealousy is usually self-centered. God's is not. God's jealousy is based on his deep love for his people and his relation to them, which brings concern for everything that happens to them and an unlimited care for them. That's his jealousy. Now, this demands that he avenge. Sooner or later, every sin will be paid for. He is of purer eyes than to behold iniquity. If he is just, then he must punish sin. And his justice is just as great as his love, and his mercy, and his long-suffering. They're all in balance in God, because God can wait. He is timeless. We want everything done in our day, at our time, at the right, when the clock has reached the right hour, or when the calendar has reached the right day of the month or week. God doesn't need to do that. He is the eternal God. But his avenging of his people is absolutely certain. He is also furious with sinful behavior. He cannot acquit the wicked acts of the enemies of his people and still remain righteous. He wouldn't be righteous if he didn't do something about it. And the reference there is chapter 1 verse 3. The Lord is slow to anger, great in power, will not at all acquit the wicked. The Lord hath his way in the whirlwind and in the storm and the clouds of the dust of his feet, and so on. Chapter 2 verses 1 to 5. He that dasheth in pieces is come up before thy face. Keep the fortress, watch the way, make thy loins strong, fortify thy power mightily. For the Lord hath turned away the excellency of Jacob as the excellency of Israel, for the emptiers have emptied them out and marred their vine branches, and so on and so on. He shall recount his nobles, they shall stumble in their walk, they shall make haste to the wall, the defense shall be prepared, and so on. He is great in power and has all the forces of nature at his command. We've already read that, the whirlwind, the storm, the powers of the deep and of the heights under his control. His purposes, therefore, no power of the universe can stand against him. Chapter 2, verse 6, he tells how it happens. The gates of the rivers shall be opened, the palace shall be dissolved. It is decreed, she shall be led away captive. She shall be brought up, and her maid shall lead her, as with the voice of doves beating upon their breasts. Nineveh is of old like a pool of water, yet they shall flee away. Stand, stand, shall they cry, but none shall look back. Nineveh was doomed. That is the capital of Assyria, of course. And the river, that was one of the ways that it was led to destruction, as indeed it was for Babylon. The enemy, in the case of Babylon, they blocked the river, the Medes and the Persians, which was Babylon's defense. They blocked it up and used the dry bed of the river as an entrance into the city. And that's how Belshazzar and his people were completely brought to naught. Chapter 2, verses 8 to 13 tells of the completeness of the judgment and the destruction. We already read verse 8. Verse 9, take the spoil of silver, take the spoil of gold. There is no end of the store and glory out of all the pleasant furniture. She is empty and void and waste, looted and plundered, of course. The heart melteth, the knees smite together, much pain is in all loins, the faces of them all gather blackness. Where is the dwelling of the lions and the feeding place of the young lions? Where the lion? Even the old lion walked and the lions whelped, and none made them afraid. The lion did tear in pieces enough for his whelps. But now all of this is completely overcome. Behold, I am against thee, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will burn her chariots in the smoke. And the sword shall devour the young lions, and I will cut off thy prey from the earth, and the voice of thy messenger shall no more be heard. Woe to the bloody city. Why would God reveal all of this to this man? I think this would bring him great peace of mind, so that he wouldn't worry and think about trying to stir up the Israeli people themselves to get their armies ready. The whole thing is in God's hand. And so when I see what's going on in the world, when I see people abducted, kidnapped, battered, smashed, shot to death, carried away over borders into child prostitution, all of this kind of thing, when I see evil men in the highest branches of the governments of our country, every once in a while the edge of the coverlet is picked up and you see the dirt underneath it. Family unfaithfulness and dirt and financial dishonesty even. I think in the present government of John Major in England, I think already something like 4 or 5 cabinet ministers have resigned in disgrace. And I don't think they're any different from any other part of the world. Maybe they should be resigning in other places as well, but they haven't been caught on yet. And these are the people who are governing our day. And if that is so in places like Britain and Canada and the United States that we happen to know about, what must it be in some of these other countries such as Yugoslavia? You don't hear much of the name of Yugoslavia anymore. I think it's finished as Yugoslavia. But Bosnia and all the rest of it, what must it be in the heart of Russia where the country appears to have been taken over by the equivalent of the mafia? Organized crime has taken over. They can't stop it. They're taking advantage of the whole new regime. Our world is teetering on the verge of Armageddon. And when it starts, it won't be just these nations, it will be the United States too. It will be Canada and the United Kingdom. For when God starts, he will clean the whole thing out for his son to reign. That gives me a feeling not of gloating over it, because it makes me shudder, as to what has to happen. But it saves me from worrying and fretting. Why do these things happen? I can leave it with God. That's what he's asking this man to do. Since God's love for them over the page and his relationship with them made their enemies, his enemies, and made his avenging action certain, they and we have no need to avenge ourselves. See Romans 2:9, 12:19, 2 Thessalonians 1:6-7, 6 and 7. We're not to avenge ourselves. We are ordered not to do it. We are prohibited from doing it. And of course we have it, don't we, in the Sermon on the Mount as well. You will be cursed. You are not to try to return the curse. You will be mocked. You are to accept it. If you're slapped in the face, you are to be prepared to take another slap and without retaliation. I don't think this means if somebody slaps you in the face, you just say, here, hit me on the other side. He probably will, and you'll deserve it if you're silly enough to do that. What the passage obviously means is that I am not to retaliate. And if I get the equivalent of a slap on the face, I'm to be ready to take another one without retaliation. It's not in my power or in my hands to retaliate. And so there are many passages to do this. Look at chapter 3, verse 8. Art thou better than populous Noamon? That's the old capital. Schofield's note on that is that Noamon, or Thebes, T-H-E-B-E-S, was the great capital of Upper Egypt, the Decapolis of the Greeks. It was the seat of government of many of the pharaohs. Its destruction was predicted in Jeremiah 46:25 and Ezekiel 30:14-16, and was carried out by Sargon of Assyria in his campaign against Egypt. This is one of those side wars in which Israel stuck its nose and got pinched. Now, this Thebes, or Noamon, was considered to be impregnable, but he's reminding Assyria, he said, you were able to bring down the most powerful stronghold in the Egyptian Empire. Noamon was not impregnable. Neither is your capital, Nineveh. What you did to Noamon will be done to you. They thought Noamon couldn't be taken. You took it. You think that Nineveh can't be taken. It will be taken. And I think it's an interesting thing to look at Isaiah chapter 19, verse 23. Isaiah, if you want to call it Isaiah, it's all right. Verse 22 says, and the Lord shall smite Egypt, he shall smite and heal it, and they shall return even to the Lord. Now, he has been picturing the day of the Lord and the end result of that in millennial blessedness. Verse 23 says, in that day shall there be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptians shall serve the Assyrians. And in that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land. whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, mine inheritance. Isn't that a wonderful set of verses? All these kingdoms are going to be part of the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ. And that means that he will rule over Russia just as he will rule over Mount Zion, because it goes to the ends of the earth. The whole world, the millennial blessing will spread over the whole of the world. And by the way, I do not believe that in those days there will be any ice caps at the North and South Poles. And I think Canada will be a more inhabitable country. I lived there for 22 years. Lovely country and wonderful people. Have to watch myself when you got at least one Canuck here, you know. Don't want to get in trouble. But if you look at a map of Canada today, only about 1/10 of it is inhabitable. The rest is all ice and snow and right up to the pole. I don't think it'll be like that in the millennium. Whatever happened to this earth? Because I'm convinced that the axis wasn't always tilted this way, and that they're
play hockey anymore.
They'll have better things to do. Better things to do. No, when you think of the climatic changes that there are going to be everywhere, I don't think there will be any Sahara. The whole earth will be a garden as God created. God didn't create Africa with about nearly half of it now a wilderness, a desert. That's not the way he created. Something happened to our earth. How many of you here have read any of Velikovsky's books? Bye-bye. Oh, feel free to wander on any time you like.
Trying to keep the
mic
from
Try it. I'm going to try and word this properly. You've touched on it, but I just have a desire maybe to touch on it again and bring it up. One of the burdens that we have is how much of the gifts of the Lord to the assembly and the very members of the body, their energies, their focus, are diverted away from the assembly and pouring their lives out for the glory of God in the assembly. In America, in the United States specifically, I don't know about Canada, there's a tremendous political brainwashing, indoctrination in this land of their little ones, that the United States is the best country in the world, the greatest nation in the world. It's almost a Christian nation. How you have to exercise your responsibility to vote, and how we've got to stand against gambling, and we've got to stand against those that are pro-choice, and we've got to get together and put our people in power, in government,
and protest, march in the streets.
It's an overwhelming thing to the point, brother, and maybe my perceptions are wrong, but I believe within evangelical Christians, this thinking has, you know, I would say the overwhelming majority of American believers feel this is their responsibility, and they're involved in these kind of things. At the expense of the assembly and the focus of what is our responsibility? I just want you to answer. If you can make some comments, I'd like to throw the ball to the rest of
you. If we started digging into this whole situation, I don't think we would get to the end of the prophets. I think basically and essentially, I would agree with Henry. These areas are not our concern. We are to pray for those in authority without ceasing. We are to pray in order that we might be able to live a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. But once we think we can cure all these things by joining organizations, by joining protest marches, by waving placards, or any other method, I think we're stepping outside the place that God has given us. Now, I think because of the nature of the subject, we'd be just as well to leave it there, but I think that basically and essentially, our concerns are God's concerns, but we have to leave His actions to Himself. Because once, for example, I consider abortion to be murder. That's my conviction. But if I go out in the street and I join a bunch of people waving sticks, I've no idea what their aims and objectives might be in this, or who they might be. They might be mere hooligans taking advantage of that demonstration to upset something else, and this often happens. We, for example, had innocent people who got out in demonstrations in the north of Ireland. The IRA took over some of these demonstrations, and the army and the police had to fire on them, and some people were killed, and then of course they screamed bloody murder because innocent people had been shot down. But vicious people had taken over the protest, and the innocent people didn't understand. They had no business being mixed up with them in the first place. I think we need to watch who we associate with in all that we do. And I think that if we are pouring our all into the Church of God, God's assembly, we will have our hands full and we will let the world rule the world. That is the way I look at it. Now, only one other thing before we go into another book, that is Habakkuk. Unless you've got something to bring up about Nahum, and I'd be glad to listen to that.
But could I ask you a question?
Yes.
You referred us back here to Isaiah 19, and it seems like you are inferring that there's a blessing yet to come for the land of Nineveh. Mm-hmm. And when we read Nahum here, it says in verse 13 of the second chapter, "Behold, I am against you, says the Lord of hosts. I will burn your chariots." It goes on to say, "I will cut off your prey from the earth, and the voice of your messengers shall be heard no more." Third chapter, fifth verse, "Behold, I am against you, says the Lord of hosts." And then he goes on to tell how bad of a spectacle He's going to make them look before the whole world. And he goes on to say at the end of it, that verse 19, the end of the book, it says, "Your injury has no healing. Your wound is so severe. All who hear the news of you will clap their hands over you, for upon whom has not your wickedness passed continually?" Mm-hmm. So I just see, you know, and Isaiah was written, I believe, what, about 740, around there. And this book is written, what, about 620, in that range. So progressively, I see this is written a lot earlier, 100 and some years later than what Isaiah was. And God's saying here, "You have transgressed so bad that I'm not even going to let Nahum come to you." He's like Jonah went into the city and preached.
Right.
And here he's not even going to send Nahum to tell him. He's just going to say, "This is, I'm going to show you what I'm going to do in my wrath to a nation who has been absolutely now in my hatred." He says, "I'm going to cut you off totally." So I see when we get to Isaiah, that if we look to any blessing, it's not the Assyria that was, but it's going to be, have to be a totally new package of Assyria to have a blessing, because he's going to cut off completely. There's not going to be any testimony left except the testimony of how wicked they were and how God deals with wickedness.
Well, of course, when we speak of them being cut off, I don't think that it would mean that every single individual would be killed, but the whole meaning of it, as I see it, is that all these evil nations, Assyria, Egypt, even Russia developed a political concept that there was no God and wiped out everybody who talked about there being a God. But God is going to change that. I think what we have with Egypt and Assyria in blessing, with a highway going through and Israel in the middle of it, is the millennium. Isaiah is talking about a different age. Because if we say that God is going to cut off all these nations, then he would destroy every nation on the earth and there wouldn't be a single individual left on the whole globe. But he's going to raise up these nations after their punishment and make the whole earth, these will be part of those who will go up on that highway saying, let us go up to Jerusalem that he may teach us the ways of the Lord. It's the millennium he's talking about. Yes, Amos.
Yeah, amen.
Sorry, Rand.
That's okay, Brother Amos. It's a good name.
Yes, it is. Well, as long as it's not Amos and Andy.
I get called that in assembly instead of Randy Amos, Andy Amos. Chapter 3 also, Bob, is just a quick point. Chapter 3 isn't to Assyria per se. It's woe to that bloody city, Nineveh. So chapter 3 is dealing with a specific part of the nation. Isaiah is dealing with the whole nation. There's no contradiction. It's just one city. So that's something.
And the city was characteristic of the nation, too. But God is going to rule. He's going to crush the evil, and he's going to bring this earth into a wonderful condition. When I believe Siberia will be growing tulips when the Lord brings everything about. I asked how many of you had read any of the books of a man called Velikovsky. One. He was a very remarkable man. He was a Jew, and I believe Russian by descent. He had a doctorate in at least four branches of study, a great musician, a great scientist, a great linguist. He accepted the Bible as history, but he believed that it was absolutely true history. But he had a theory about the stars and the earth, which the scientists of his day, he only died a few years ago, but the scientists did everything they possibly could to block his books. One of them was called Worlds in Collision. Another was called Ages in Chaos. Another was called The People of the Moon. His theory was that the earth at one time had been totally different from what it is today. Now, I'm not going to justify all his theories, but really what he was setting out to do was to demolish, from a scientific viewpoint, the whole theory of evolution. And he did a massive job on it. When his first books, when he started to get his first books published, the scientific world were so shocked at what he was saying that they told the publishers who had agreed to publish the books that if they published his books, all the orders for the books of scientists from Harvard and all the other big centers of scientific study, including all the leading astronomers of the United States, were so mad at him that they said if this book company published his books, they would withdraw all their future publication from them. Now, they were publishing house for scientific literature, and every book they published, there would be thousands of it marked for sale before it went on the market at all. This so frightened them that they rejected his book, and he had to have it printed in another by another company. About certain stars, he said that they were extremely hot. The scientists before him said no, they weren't. They were freezing, but when the space vehicles went out there, they proved that he was right and they were wrong, except he was dead by this time. He had said a whole lot of things that they condemned. I think it's very good reading for Christians. You may not agree with all his theories, but he absolutely demolishes scientifically the whole theory of evolution.